I have to find out where is what. Okay, so this will be the Monitor. Kannst du es auch tauschen? Okay, so let me start by extending a great thank you to particular Niklas and Matthias, who have been organizing a great conference so far, I think. And for giving me the opportunity to present some recent work of ours in collaboration with James Drummond from ANSI and Johannes Henn, who's also at Humboldt University. It's a paper from earlier this year. I'll start out with some motivational slides, which are almost unnecessary in this audience, but still, I would like to stress that we're really, with the ADS-CFT correspondence, dealing with a fascinating link between a gravitational and a non-gravitational theory, and that we have seen certainly great progress here in the maximal supersymmetric ADS-5-CFT-4 system. In particular, we are close to or have already seen the solution of a spectral problem. In parallel to these developments, there has been very nice work in studying scattering amplitudes in this maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, in particular making use of generalized unitarity methods. And there are, motivated from the string side, fascinating connections to light-like Wilson loops, and we have seen the emergence of a dual superconformal symmetry of a planar n equals 4 Young-Mills theory, about which we have heard quite a lot by Gregory just before me. And the theme of my talk is, or let's say the goal of this research project is the question whether we can connect the two, right? So the field theory under investigation is one we all know and love. It's n equals 4 super Young-Mills, and I like the wording that you should think about it as the hydrogen atom of gauge theories. So I won't go through all the details. I want to stress that we are, of course, as we want to connect to integrability, only interested in the planar sector of that theory. It is, as it stands, the most symmetric four-dimensional gauge theory we know. And so the symmetry group is next to the conformal SO2,4, the R symmetry SO6, augmented by supersymmetry and superconformal symmetries to the PSU22/4 group. And I've here listed all the relevant generators. So we have Poincaré transformations, we have the Lorentz symmetries here in a formalism where I use wild spinner indices alpha and alpha dot running from 1 to 2, conformal generators, the R symmetry, the Poincaré supersymmetry generators, and the conformal supersymmetry generators. And it is quite, it's often convenient to put this, including a central charge, so this would then we would then be speaking about SU22/4 in a supermatrix notation, a 4x4 supermatrix, with these A bar indices running here, and the algebra you can then compactly write down as such. We know a great deal about two-point functions in this theory. We know a lot less about three-point functions. And this should also be an interesting area to investigate in the future, I think. What can we say about the structure function CABC for non-protected operators? Another class of interesting observables are Wilson loops, which have also enlarged our knowledge of this ADS-CFT system quite a lot. And the class I'll be particularly interested in are exclusively interested in this talk are the scattering amplitudes, which are UV finite in this theory, but IR divergent. And the external particles have helicities ranging from 0 to 1. So the dual superstring is also known, of course, ADS5 cross S5. And in this audience, I think I don't have to say much more. Good. So how do these gauge theory observables connect to string theory observables? Scaling dimensions are a link to the spectrum of the string, and there, depending on your taste or your definition of solved, we at least have a a concrete conjecture for how you should compute these scaling dimensions, also for the finite size problem now. On the level of a structure constant, I think we know very little. We don't even really know how we would do a string theory calculation on the CFT side. So there is, of course, a Witten prescription based on supergravity to compute higher point functions, but how we do this for non-protected operators, I think, is an open and interesting question. Scattering amplitudes have received through the work of Alda Malacena a dual description in terms of open string amplitudes on such an IR brain, and via this Wilson loop connection, we also have quantitative information there at weak coupling, which brings me here to the last point, that we also have an understanding of how to compute Wilson loops in this duality. As I said, this talk is focusing on the question of scattering amplitudes and, in particular, their symmetries restricted to the tree level here. So what I want to discuss is the class of n-particle scattering amplitudes in a so-called color-ordered formalism, which also Gregory introduced in the beginning of his talk. So first of all, the external states are labeled by incoming momenta ranging from 1 to n, and associated helicities denoting the type of particle being scattered. So scalar for helicity 0, gluon plus minus 1, and plus minus 1 half of the gluinos. And the trick with the color ordering is that you you strip off the color structure through this trace here, and you sum over all permutations modulo cyclicity under the trace in order to express the general amplitude. So then the study is free of a color problem, and you just have to compute these partial amplitudes here, which depend, as I said, on the momenta and the helicities of the ingoing particles of a coupling constant, of course, and generally of epsilon if you work in dimensional regularization. So it is for this problem very convenient to make use of a spinner helicity formalism, which makes use of expressing the general momenta of an external particle in terms of a product of two commuting spinners, lambda and lambda tilde, which automatically implement the masslessness condition of the external legs. So the determinant of such a matrix vanishes, and it also incorporates the helicity structure. So if we look at gluons, you can, as a matter of fact, read off the associated helicities being defined by external lambda and lambda tilde, depending on the helicity of the external leg by these formulas, where mu is an arbitrary auxiliary reference spinner in this game. Moreover, we've seen that before, but let me define it again. We have this angular and square bracket formulation for the untildeted and for the tildeted spinners, which are contracted with the epsilon tensor in that fashion. So, for example, a scalar product would then be expressed in this fashion, or even shorter. Often you just drop the lambda and lambda tilde by just 1, 2, 2, 1. Good. So there's a lot of knowledge about the structure of these scattering amplitudes, and I will be, in this talk, practically exclusively interested in only the tree-level amplitudes. So, but nevertheless, for any loop level, due to supersymmetric ward identities, one can show that the all plus or one flipped spinner helicity amplitude, and this in a convention where all particles are ingoing, vanish. And the first non-vanishing amplitude are the so-called the first class of non-vanishing amplitudes are the so-called maximally helicity variolating amplitudes, which have two flipped helicities. So, for example, let me flip the 1 and the j, which I did here. Then you have for the tree level expression here. This is the maximal helicity violating amplitude at tree level. You have this very compact and beautiful Park-Taylor formula, which gives it to you in a closed expression for any number of external legs n. And of course, you have higher loop corrections to this, which the ultimate goal here would be to determine exactly. It turns out that you can always factorize out this leading the leading tree level result, and all the polarization dependence then sits in here, and the remaining curly M function here is only a function of the various Mandelstam invariants you have in the problem. Based on explicit perturbative studies, these gentlemen here were led to a conjecture for the all loop structure of these maximally helicity violating amplitudes, which is quite remarkable, namely that the logarithm of the n loop piece is given by the one loop structure multiplied by the cusp anomalous dimension, which has also featured in the study of scaling dimensions in the ADS CFT system. So this function we know, thanks to the work of Beisert, Eden, and Staudacher, to all loop orders. This gives us the finite piece. There are also 1 over epsilon squared and 1 over epsilon IR divergencies, which are also under complete control, but I didn't spell this out here on this transparency. So based on this conjecture, you have all loop information for n-particle MHV amplitude. It turns out that this conjecture is not exactly correct and only true for 4 and 5 n's, and there are corrections through so-called remainder function starting at n equals 6. But nevertheless, I would like to stress that there's already quite a large deal of information we have, namely we know all 4 and 5 point amplitudes to all loop orders in this theory. Once one starts turning one's attention to the next to maximal helicity violating amplitudes, so the n MHVs, and k then tells you how many additional flips you have made, the structures become a lot more complicated, and that calls for a better formulation which makes use of a supersymmetry in the problem. And this is this is performed by making use of an on-shell superspace formalism for describing these amplitudes in the following fashion, which also Gregory Kochemsky introduced in his talk. So we will introduce a Grassmann variable eta for every leg, which runs from 1 to 4, and then every external leg will be given by specifying a superwave function or a superstate, which incorporates the full n equals 4 multiplet. So we start with a plus helicity gluon, then we have plus 1/2 gluino state, the scalars, minus 1/2 gluino state, and minus 1 gluon state, which is all compactly subsumed in one expression. And then the amplitudes will be expressed as functions of these on-shell superspace variables, lambda tilde I. I missed an I here, and eta I. So what you've done is you've in a sense repackaged whole classes of gluon, gluino, and scalar amplitudes into one object, and by performing the eta expansion, you can then pick out the various amplitudes of the physical particles you're interested in. So an example of this, which we've seen in the previous talk as well, is now an expression of MHV superamplitude, which takes the following form. Note, in comparison to the previous formula, that this factor ij to the power of 4 has now disappeared in favor of a fermionic delta function, which is given here. And this fermionic delta function imposes the fermionic momentum associated with every particle. Here again is an I missing, so lambda I times eta I we identify with a fermionic momentum, and we have complete fermionic momentum conservation in analogy to the ordinary bosonic momentum conservation being expressed in this delta function. If you now perform the eta expansion, which by making use of this representation of the delta function, you pick out, say, the order 4 terms in eta, you can recover exactly this MHV expression we had before. Good. So in general, if we leave the class of MHV amplitudes, a general super amplitude would be expressible in the following, or it's conveniently expressed in the following. So you have this MHV prefactor, and then you have a general function P, which has an own eta expansion, and the order eta, the order zero term in eta, it's just the MHV part, and the higher you go in your eta expansion, the more you go away from MHV. So the next to MHV is then the quadratic term in eta, and so on. So what are the symmetries of these amplitudes? And let's restrict from now to the tree level. So one can show that the super amplitude AN is invariant under the full super conformal group, even extended by the central charge C, which we've spelled out on this transparencies here, in the sense that all these generators annihilate this super amplitude. And for this, you give a realization of these PSU22/4 generators in this on-shell superspace, which was done by Witten in a paper, which then take the following form here. So we have on the one side the obvious symmetries, if you wish, so the P and the Q. If you express them in lambdas and etas, it's obvious that the momentum and fermionic momentum conserving delta function take care of these symmetries. But you have less obvious symmetries, which are second-order differential operators in the spinners and in eta, which are associated to the conformal and the superconformal generators K and S. What is also important, and in particular for the following discussion, is that we indeed have a local invariance in helicity, or equivalently in the central charge CI. Because what do I mean by local? You can think of all these generators as as densities of these generated densities, which we sum over all particles participating in the scattering process. But the helicity was, so the superamplitude is engineered in such a way that for every leg you have a uniform helicity equal to 1, and this helicity is related to the central charge by 1 minus CI. So therefore, the central charge also annihilates the tree level amplitude locally for any point I. So here I've spelled out the complete form of these generators for you. So P, K, M, R, etc. It should be noted that this invariance, which I'm stating here, in particular, with again noting this local invariance in C, is not exactly true if one takes into account the situation that you have collinear momenta, which give rise to holomorphic anomalies, which were studied recently in this paper, and Tristan spoke about it, which then actually lead you away from, well, it forces you to look at classes of amplitudes for varying number of legs, but I won't go into this. Good. So a very efficient way of computing tree-level gluon amplitudes in general, and in particular in N equals 4 super young Mills, was invented by Brito Carcasso, Feng, and Witten in terms of on-shell recursion techniques, which allowed, for example, to find a closed formula for a general split helicity gluon amplitude for any number of external legs, but which, for strangely enough, took almost 4 years till people started to develop the same recursion relations for in the super language, so including the eta, and that turned out to be much more powerful. In particular, this recursion can now be solved exactly, and I think in a very remarkable paper of my collaborators, they managed to write down the the general analytical solution of an n particle scattering amplitude in the theory, and that includes, in particular, the pure Yang-Mills result, because the tree-level amplitudes, as we also heard from Gregory, are universal. So you could now make use of this result and integrate out eters to find a closed analytical formula for n gluon scattering. But another important development was the understanding of scattering amplitudes in the dual string theory, brought to us by Alda and Maldacena, which through a reformulation of a problem via t-duality argued that the scattering amplitudes should be expressible as Wilson loops in this dual space, Wilson loops with light-like segments, and in particular that the momenta of the external states, of the external supergluons, are related to the positions of these Wilson loops, so the lying on the boundary of a dual ADS space, are given by this difference relation. So what one is facing is the problem of computing Wilson loops which are polygonal with light-like boundaries. And the same structure was also observed in the study of four-point conformal integrals before that. But what is particularly interesting is that mapped, or this understanding from in the dual string theory side, led to a way of computing the strong coupling prediction for a four-gluon MHV amplitude, by making use of classical string theory, so by finding this minimal surface. And recently there has been work by Maldacena and Aldai extending this to a particular kinematical sector of eight gluon scattering, which perhaps you'll hear more tomorrow. In any case, for the four gluons, one can perform a test of the BDS conjecture in the sense that we making use of this duality, have a prediction what the strong coupling form of this amplitude is, and it matches the lambda to infinity limit of a cusp anomalous dimension. So it checks this BDS formula for n equals 4. Nicely, this duality exists also at the weak coupling level. So instead, the computation of maximally helicity violating gluon amplitudes in n equals 4 super Yang-Mills is dual to the computation of this a particular polygonal light-like shaped Wilson loop, whose cusps are determined by these relations, by the differences of the dual coordinates x. And this has been checked up to two loops, and for the duality has been checked up to two loops for n smaller than 6 points. And this was also where this discrepancy to the BDS conjecture appeared at two-loop level. Nevertheless, the Wilson loop scattering amplitude duality remains robust. So this connection, this duality which we have here to this dual momentum space and the differences in x also led to the insight that there should be a dual conformal invariance, because the Wilson loop computed here has a conformal invariance properties, and that then translates to dual conformal covariance properties of the scattering amplitudes. Even more, one can extend this dual conformal symmetry to a full superconformal symmetry, and there one goes to a dual on-shell superspace. So just as we augmented our lambdas with the eta, we will now augment our difference variables x with a theta. And these x's and thetas then have standard transformation laws under the dual superconformal transformations. And one can write down a representation. One can then write down a dual superconformal algebra for all these capitalized generators here, which act in this on-shell superspace. And I've spelled out the first the first couple of generators here on this transparency. So again, you can see that with this notation, I mean, I take the derivative with respect to x alpha alpha dot, so only the indices tell you what we're looking at. So what we want to, in order to be able to study the action of these operators on scattering amplitudes, we have to understand how they act on the original, the standard on-shell superspace coordinates, lambda and theta. And eta, excuse me. And what one does technically is one extends the case by actions in the standard on-shell superspace, such that these generators commute with the constraints up there. And after having done that, one can then study the action of the dual conformal and the dual conformal K and the dual conformal S on the tree-level amplitudes, and one discovers that they are covariant. So they pick up this sum over all x's or sum over all thetas in the action, and that is exclusively from the denominator in this angular brackets that these amplitudes carry. So one can just swap this over to the other side and then say that these tilde generators, k tilde and s tilde, annihilate the amplitude. So these are the symmetries of the tree-level amplitude. A natural question is, what happens if once one goes beyond tree level? And this was also discussed by my previous speaker. What happens is that the dual superconformal symmetry is broken by IR divergences, which I encounter at loop level. However, this breaking is under control, is mildly, if you wish, and controlled by this cusp anomalous dimension, an understanding which was obtained by studying the problem in the dual Wilson loop language. So, and there is the conjecture that this dual superconformal anomaly is universal not only for MHV and next to MHV where it was checked, but for all amplitudes. But this will leave for later. What I want of the outset of our work was the, in some sense, natural question: if you have that structure, if you have the dual superconformal symmetry and the ordinary of a standard superconformal symmetry, a natural question which arises is what algebraic structure emerges if you study the commutation of these two sets of generators. And in order to do this, one has to, in a sense, get rid of the x's and thetas again, which you introduced in between. And the way this was performed is, first of all, we can think, and we should think perhaps, of such an n-particle scattering amplitude as a spin chain, with the state of the spins being labeled by the external wave function, super wave functions. And what one does is one opens up the chain by giving up the condition that the n plus first point is equal to x1 and the same in the fermionic space, because this is in any case implemented by the delta functions which stand up front. So the delta functions force the chain to be closed, and this is nothing but the statement of having momentum and fermionic momentum conservation. Once you do that, you can re-express the xi's and the theta i's by summing over the lower ones, starting by one singled out, x1 and theta 1, the place where you opened up these chains. However, if you look at the form of these dual generators, the dual superconformal generators, which, no, they're not here. Sorry, I got mixed up. Then, in a sense, they're just translations in X space, right? Here we have them. So this is just a translation in X, and this is just a translation in theta space. You can use these in order to choose a coordinate system, say, where X1 and theta 1 are at the origin. So you kill X1 and theta 1 by using the translation P and the Poincaré ZQ, and then you have completely solved for the xi's and theta i's, and you can drop all the xi and theta i's derivatives in the superconformal generators. So then you end up with exactly this structure of the generator. So these are the dual PSU22 slash 4 generators. We've used P and Q, so they are zero now. And the rest we can now write down explicitly. And what you see here explicitly is that you have only two novel structures. The others are all related to the original SU22 slash 4 generators. So Q bar is S bar, M is M, M bar is M, R is R, D is D, C is C, S is new, S bar is Q bar, and K is new. All right. Good. So if one plugs in this solution for the XIs in the K generator, which is down here, actually K tilde, because we have shifted by this sum over all X's. And what you immediately see is that you obtain a non-local structure if you think of it in terms of a density sitting here, because you sum over all lower lambdas and etas sitting below this particular I place where you're sitting in this internal sum. And this structure is, of course, reminiscent to a Jungian generators, and as a matter of fact, one can show that these dual superconformal generators K and S can be lifted, can be extended. One has to add in a couple of further terms which are just products of the standard conformal or superconformal generators. They can be lifted to a Jungian structure, which was the main observation of our paper. So this is this is the structure that you find. So let's see. So now I rewrote everything in terms of generators JA of the, first of all, this is a conventional superconformal symmetry. And then we have a level one transformation law here. So we have the Jungian is, you introduce levels. The zeroth level is just the ordinary superconformal symmetry algebra, and the first excited level, the J1, is then given by this non-local structure where you sum over J smaller than I, and you use this inverted structure constant FCBA in order to write this object down, and in order to have a closed structure, you also have to show that a certain class of, generalization of Jacobi's identity for this Jungian structure is obeyed, the so-called Serre relations, or in our case, the super Serre relations, and they are, as a matter of fact, representation dependent, but that can be done and was indeed done or argued by these people. And we checked some aspects of it, so we do have a complete realization of this Jungian symmetry. Acting on the tree-level amplitudes. So just to show you how it looks explicitly, let's look at the bosonic Jungian generator at level one. So this would be P1. It's actually related to the dual K and some additions we have to add in, and that's the explicit structure you find. So it's written as products of densities of a standard generators summed in an ordered fashion along this chain. And in making use of the supermatrix notation, which I showed you at the very beginning, this is an extremely nice and compact form of these generators, I think. So what we have discovered here is that we have, again, if you wish, an integrable spin chain picture emerging in the study of these color-ordered scattering amplitudes. And that structure also, or the Jungian structure which one uncovers, is leading you to an infinite dimensional symmetry algebra acting on these n equals 4 superangular scattering amplitudes, which gives good hope, I think, that once you can extend it to the loop level, you can really make use of integrable properties here. That's right. In a sense, I mean, we don't. In a sense, we're we're looking at states which are annihilated by all generators. We don't really have an analog of a Hamiltonian here yet. Yes, they're all singlets, that's right. Although there might be subtleties coming in when you take these collinear sectors into account, and then you might not be able to restrict to change of finite size, fixed size. So then you will have, you might have to look at the class of all n amplitudes. One point which is often brought up when you discuss Jungians in such cyclic systems, which we have two here, which was brought up by Niklas and also independently by Witten, is that how can it be? Because we know that these amplitudes should be cyclically invariant. However, by singling out a single particle, I mean, the point where I opened up the chain, particle number one, I clearly violated this cyclicity structure. So we would not expect complete annihilation, say, of the amplitude, but rather to pick up some boundary terms in doing so. And then only the limit of n to infinity or so, you could forget that. I mean, that's a structure you often have in closed spin chain systems. But the resolution is quite quite nice, and I think general, very general for this class of superalgebras here. How could we? I mean, what happens? So let's say we do not open the chain at point one, but we open it at point two. Then we would have defined a Jungian generator at level one, which sums ordered from two to n plus one, and then we compute what is the difference of these two objects. And once you go through the algebra, you see it is proportional exactly to delta AB times C1, the point where we initially did the cut. And now the important property comes to our rescue, that C is not only globally but locally annihilating the amplitude. So that's why the whole thing is indeed cyclic. And in performing this calculation, actually what enters prominently is the vanishing of the killing form of a superalgebra. So this property here should be true for all superalgebras with vanishing killing form. And quite interestingly, that was one of the criteria that Kostya Tserembo had in his talk for classifying possible integrable sigma models. Okay, so this brings me to the summary of my talk, which I think is most ideally summarized by this picture here, whose idea I stole from Niklas. So what we have shown is that the combination of the standard and the dual superconformal symmetry lifts to a Jungian structure, and here's how you can think about it. So the level zero is the standard superconformal symmetry. So here you have the generators P0, Q0, K0, S0, S-bar, and Q-bar. And then cut in this direction are the generators, or is the dual superconformal algebra. So here you have K, capital K and S, P and Q, and Q-bar and S-bar. So they intersect at this node here. And the Jungian structure is then given by this line here and all higher levels as well by keeping on commuting. And in order to introduce this, we sort of exhausted P and Q, set it to zero by setting this point x1 and theta1 to zero, and this is the structure that emerges. And this Jungian then annihilates all three-level amplitudes in the theory. So, of course, we have seen Jungians before in the study of a spectral problem. Only quoted, we had talks here, and I probably didn't include all relevant authors here. So I think we should take this as a strong hint for integrability in scattering amplitudes. There are two challenges, or at least two challenges, I think, and interesting questions to pursue. I mean, important question, and the challenge is whether this Jungian symmetry extends to the loop level, and in particular, if it does, to what extent it can constrain the form of the amplitudes. And we understand very well, and that's kind of funny, we understand very well the breaking of a dual conformal invariance at loop level. It's completely under control, and we heard a lot about it in Gregory's talk. But we don't yet control the breaking of standard conformal invariance at loop level. Another question is, we know that the Jungian symmetry is also there, the Jungian structure is also there at strong coupling in the dual string theory, thanks to the work of Berkowitz, Maldacena, and Beisert, Zietlin, Wolf, and another person I can't remember right now. But now let's look at it explicitly acting on the strong coupling. On the strong coupling conformal of the amplitudes. So are they invariant under the Jungian symmetry, and what can we learn from that side? And a further important question, which has been already discussed here also at this conference, is, first of all, before we start asking the loop question, is the form of the tree amplitudes fixed by the dual superconformal and conformal symmetry, alias the Jungian symmetry? And to my understanding, the lesson that I took is that one really has to, in order to do this, one has to include collinear. One has to take into account these physical limits, in particular the situation of collinear momenta, and that is related to length-changing effects and deformations already of the tree-level structure of the generators. And the really fascinating question is whether this can constrain the form of a higher loop amplitudes, and therefore. You could imagine that you're going to set up certain differential equations coming from this, which the amplitudes have to obey, and then potentially also allow you, as a first step, but I think it would already be a great success of such a program, to allow you to fix this famous remainder function, starting with 6 points for the MHV amplitudes. That was all I wanted to tell you. Thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
You know more or less the list of quantities which we can, in principle, calculate in the integrable spin chains or sigma models, and it's a very short list. To what of these quantities could correspond the amplitudes you calculate? Could you give some correspondence between correlators and these quantities, if you hope that it's integrable in the same sense as, for example, the spectral problem?
I'm not sure I completely understand your question, so what do you want me to do?
If you want to calculate amplitudes, and what quantities should you calculate in, say, in corresponding spin chain, etc.? Wave function, for example. Yes?
I won't tell you. No. So in terms of, if I think of a spin chain system, yes, I wouldn't. There's this analogy. I think it's just the beginning. I don't think we really understand it yet. Just saying we have this structure. And I have the hope that there's more to be found, but I can't really. I think I know. I sort of feel what you want me to say, but I can't. I mean, I can't really pin it down.
Maybe the wave function.
Well, certainly the amplitude is the wave function. Yes. But it's the ground state wave function. So, how interesting. I mean, okay. Do you? Well, it's, I don't know.
Physicist question. At the very beginning, you start from two symmetries, both as infinite dimensional symmetries. You have conventional and dual superconformal symmetries. You have constraints on your amplitude. Number of the constraint is finite. Already solving finite number of constraints, you see some ambiguity, and okay, you have collinear limit to fix the ambiguity. Now you go to Jungian. So going to Jungian, you just commute the generator of two symmetries and you impose the conditions that they should annihilate. But you agree with me that the moment you satisfied finite number of the equation which correspond to the vanishing of amplitude with respect to symmetries, you already automatically guaranteed that Jungian will annihilate your amplitude. So now my question is, what good you gain if you're replacing the problem of solving finite number of differential equation by the problem of solving infinite number of equations which you know secretly invariant to the finite number of equation?
So I agree that we have not, I mean, in terms of, you know, physical output, we have not gained more in rewriting the dual superconformal symmetries now in this Yangian structure. My hope would be that indeed if I go to loop order, or if I include the collinear subtleties, that the guiding line will be to maintain this Yangian structure. So I will deform all generators, and I will have to deform them in such a fashion that that the Yangian structure is preserved. So that would be my hope.
Do you believe that such deformation exists? That you could? Do you believe that there exists such deformation that you will observe all anomaly into redefinition of the generators?
Yes.
You can see the multi-rigid kinematics. These scattering amplitudes have remarkable symmetry, no, integrability, really. And you can describe this integrability in terms of spin model. Yes, Geisenberg spin model, but open spin, Geisenberg spin model. And therefore, in my opinion, the method which were developed for calculation of anomalous dimensions can be applied also to scattering amplitude. But in my case, instead of this, no, I had also this transformation from momenta to difference of coordinates, but this transformation was symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian and all integrals of motion. No, I mean for colorless, no, for objects which are colorless objects, it was symmetry of Hamiltonian. It is, in your case, it is not symmetry, it is not transformation. Some canonical transformation, and you obtain this conformal invariance, of course. Do you have some hope that indeed this transformation will be symmetry of something like Hamiltonian? Maybe it is possible to introduce some Hamiltonian on spin chain, and this Hamiltonian will be invariant under this transformation from momentum to coordinate to difference of this coordinate.
Uh-huh.
Is it some hope that this symmetry, which was observed in two dimensions, no, I mean, for high energy scattering, can be generalized to four dimensions?
Well, for sure, it will not be a symmetry of a Lagrangian, because it's only it won't be a symmetry of a Lagrangian of n equals 4 super Mills, because it only exists in the planar limit. And I think there should be ways to construct an analogous spin chain which would be invariant under the symmetry.
We have this spin chain. Is it possible to generalize this spin chain for orbitary kinematics?
For
orbitary kinematics, not only for multi-rigid kinematics.
I don't know.
Sorry. Maybe it's the same question which Lev asked, but just to say it in a different word. Do you have representation, non-trivial representation of Yangian? Your amplitude is annihilated by Yangian. Is there any object which would be transformed in a non-trivial representation of this Yangian? I think it's the same question.
Yeah, but what would you gain if you had such an object?
It's some kind of spectrum generating symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Yangian would generate spectrum or generate states from other states or something.
I mean, I think a well-defined question would also be whether you can find the local conserved charges of this integrable system.
That's
something you could try. So you would have to, you know, find a transfer matrix when you take the spectral parameter infinity, it produces you with Yangian structures. And this, I mean, ideally, this transfer matrix would annihilate the amplitudes as well. And then you could find by expanding at one of these shift points or so, for if you could generate all the local conserved charges, which would also annihilate the amplitudes. That would be perhaps something.
Thank you. I have also a small technical remark that in verifying cyclic symmetry, I think, if I remember correctly, you also use that J equals zero besides Casimir. You also use that global symmetry access zero.
Yes, sure.
Thank you.
I actually have one comment and then one question maybe to both of the session speakers. So the existence of the BCFW recursion relation tells you that, in fact, you don't really need to know about the dual conformal symmetry or about the conformal symmetry in order to determine all the amplitudes. It's sufficient to know the collinear factorization and the multiparticle factorizations. And if I understand Tristan's talk correctly from yesterday, the claim is that you can substitute for multiparticle factorization the use of the two, if you like, the Yangian in its modified form. Now, if you go on to loop amplitudes, to one loop, two loops, and higher loops, then we know that the amplitudes are entirely determined by unitarity. So again, you don't actually need, in principle, the Yangian symmetries in order to compute them. But the problem is that as you go to higher and higher loop order, the structure of the branch cuts, the structure of the discontinuities gets more and more complicated. And the hope would be that you could assemble that entire complex of information using some deformation of the Yangian structure that extended to higher loops. And I think that's maybe the kind of thing that, I hope you agree with that statement.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah.
That's what I would be hoping for, yes.
So the question is that if the ordinary conformal symmetry is, after all, broken really by infrared effects, and infrared effects are universal, why shouldn't there be some universal description of the conformal, ordinary conformal anomaly? I don't know if you want to comment or if Gregory wants to.
First of all, as we're trying to emphasize, there are three anomalies which you have to control. If you want to put your hands on all anomalies, there are three anomalies. And I was describing first two, but I didn't touch upon the third one. The reason I do so, because the third one is the most complicated one. And it's not true to say that conventional conformal anomaly, even though infrared singularities are universal, you control this conventional conformal anomaly. Actually, this conventional conformal anomaly is the hardest things to control. And the reason for this being that technically the second order differential operator, or another way of saying it, is a non-local operator. So it doesn't generate infinitesimal transformations, and normally all anomalies that people are controlling so far, those which are corresponding to infinitesimal transformations. Number one. Second point.
A mathematician's answer to a physicist's question.
My personal opinion that the hardest anomaly to control is a conventional conformal anomaly. And this is one which knows most about this Riemannian function which left undetermined.
Audience? If not, let's thank the session speakers again.